drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready.
Stigma affects many aspects of society, whether we look at race, identity, socioeconomic status, former incarceration, chosen profession, or different mental or physical conditions or abilities. Today we have the opportunity to speak to Christopher Diamond of Stand Against Stigma about ways that we can address and mitigate the effects of stigma.
Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and hosted here on KKRN, kkrn.org, out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista, California. As you know, we're in conversation with people in the community who are working for criminal legal system reform or around issues that affect the ability to have such reform. And today I'm speaking with Christopher Diamond, who leads the Stand Against Stigma effort in our county. And I'll let Christopher say more about who they are and how they came to this work.
Sure. I'm Christopher Diamond. I work for the Shasta County Health and Human Services Agency, and we're lucky to have a program called Stand Against Stigma that as someone who has been sort of transformed by the program itself, it's been kind of an honor to carry it forward. I feel like I'm a public servant. I don't really treat my career as just a job. I value our community, and I have always been trying to be someone who creates space for people and creates possibilities for change. And like many HHSA employees, we all want to be a part of building a healthy community and helping people thrive.
Before we get into the particulars about Stand Against Stigma, what it is and what it does, can you tell us how you came to be interested in the work and to work in those arenas of stigma and outreach and all of those things?
Mm-hmm. I guess because I'm a public servant, I don't normally talk about my personal experience with it, but in this interview, it is relevant. I first became involved with Stand Against Stigma as a Brave Faces advocate almost a decade ago.
Wow.
Brave Faces are, in short, Shasta County residents who share their stories of mental health or substance use recovery. And there was a healing power to being able to stand up and share my experience and for the most part be honored and believed while sharing. However, I think what the program really did for me is that it helped me see beyond my diagnoses. From the point I was diagnosed, I dealt with heavy self-stigma and isolation as a consequence of the shame that I felt. So participating in Brave Faces was, like I said, really transformative for me. And it slowly helped me change the way that I thought about myself. And that has been absolutely crucial for my long-term recovery. And when I talk to other Brave Faces, they often note how sharing their story is a part of their wellness. And it's definitely a part of mine. Being able to be in the coordinator role now, my hope is that people involved in the program, whether they're Brave Faces or people who serve on the committee or just help out now and then, are able to see themselves in an uplifting way if they have lived experience. And people who don't have that firsthand experience, I hope they are able to gain an understanding of sort of the impacts stigma has and are empowered to take action to stop stigma.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you this later, but for listeners, maybe it's a good idea to begin with how you define stigma when you're talking about it to community groups or explaining the importance of a program like Brave Faces.
Mm-hmm. I like to use the definition that Dr. Patrick Corrigan uses. He's kind of the person who has essentially spearheaded the movement to end stigma around especially mental illness. And what he says is the stigmatization of people with mental disorders is manifested by bias, distrust, stereotyping, fear, embarrassment, anger, and or avoidance. Stigma leads the public to avoid people with mental disorders. It reduces self-esteem and increases isolation and hopelessness. More tragically, it deprives people of their dignity and interferes with their full participation in society. So that's kind of a definition that I carry with me. And then when Brave Faces, when we're helping craft stories and everything, and they're sharing them, we do ask them to share some of what they think stigma is and how it has interfered with their well-being. So I guess in a sense, I don't have one single definition that I can think of for stigma, because there's so many layers to it for people, that every experience of stigma is almost unique. And it's kind of that individual situation where sort of the best practice would be to step back and just allow someone to tell you their experience and honor that. So, but some of the themes that we see as far as stigma that people have had to grapple with, some people dealt with a lot of stigma within their family, to the point to where their family was not okay with them taking medication. They had to battle against that, which is not something you hear very often. Some people get a lot of their healing space from a church or a religious community. And at times, religious communities, because there is their own beliefs about mental health, can be very well intentioned and trying to be kind, but they miss some of the parts that the parts of treatment that are actually key for someone to heal from mental illness. And then there's other Brave Faces, and this might be actually a common thread, is that there's people who just think people with mental illness are less of people because they have the challenge. So those are some of the common themes that we have amongst our Brave Faces. And really, to change this is what people can learn. Facts about substance use. They can listen to people and their experiences. And that's one of the reasons the Stand Against Stigma program exists, is to help the community build a broader understanding of what mental illness is and not continue to use what society and the media have really perpetuated these myths and stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to have you explain to us what Stand Against Stigma, the sort of broader umbrella, is, and Brave Faces. But first, you said something that I wanted to follow up on. Mm-hmm. You talked about that sometimes churches, due to particular beliefs or doctrines or values, can miss, I'm going to forget exactly how you said it, but miss important elements necessary for a person's healing. Can you call to mind a concrete example of that, like what that might look like for someone who might not have an idea?
Mm-hmm. There's one of our Brave Faces in their story. They talk about how the Christian faith, God, and faith are really the cornerstone of their wellness. And when explaining their mental health condition to someone at a church, a lot of times it might be you just need to have faith. You just need to pray harder. You don't need to, I believe the quote she used was, you don't need to speak that over your life. And these are all, you know, ways of being encouraging in the faith, mm-hmm. and ways of, people think they're being kind, but, that stigmatizes the treatments that the individual wanted to pursue. And so she had to overcome that stigma and reconcile her faith with some of the beliefs in the church. So,
mm-hmm. talking about the Stand Against Stigma program and Brave Faces, can you tell us about Stand Against Stigma, sort of its mission and particular activities, and then Brave Faces in particular?
So Stand Against Stigma's mission is to promote mental wellness, increase community awareness of mental health, and end the stigma surrounding mental illness and substance use. And also we try to address, because they get woven into the stories, things like homelessness, suicide, suicide loss even, and incarceration. So, and the program has been around since 2012. And a big part of the program, one of the more effective ways to fight stigma is that personal contact with someone who has lived experience. So Brave Faces was essentially born out of that. And it's really the cornerstone of the Stand Against Stigma program. We have a speakers bureau, so we have several different stories, and we're always encouraging people to become Brave Faces advocates and share their stories. They're all volunteers. We just sort of end up with a diverse range of experiences, from diagnosis to life experiences, families, background. And then because there's an understanding that there are intersections, you know, when it comes to stigma and race or religion. Mm-hmm. We also try work to ensure that we're getting representation from all different communities, whether those are different faith communities or if it's a Native American community. And also we have some speakers from the LGBTQ community. So we're always trying to make sure that we're able to, have someone relatable for almost anyone in our county. We've presented to as young as middle school, all the way up through master's levels classes. Brave Faces have shared their stories for volunteer trainings, staff trainings, rotary clubs, support groups, churches. One of the ones that we've been doing a couple times a year since, I think, 2018, 2019, is presenting for the law enforcement crisis intervention team trainings. So we always have some people with lived experience come and share their story at those. And we get to present to nursing students. Police cadets, we've even had experience with that. And then it's also interesting that we can also present to masters in social work and marriage and family therapist classes too, so they can experience, some different, learn from different experiences before they're put into a counseling one-on-one situation. Mm-hmm. So, and then to help push the message out and you sort of spread it further in the community. We have an online gallery that features all the Brave Faces stories, which are also shared on social media. And we have a physical gallery that we rotate throughout the county of different Brave Faces so people can read some stories maybe while they're sitting at the doctor's office waiting to go in. And make those connections, especially in sort of the rural parts of the county, where it can be a little bit more difficult to get access. So, Brave Faces has shown to have a measured impact on reducing stigma. Overall, it's widely known that contact with people living with mental health or substance use challenges has been shown to be effective in reducing stigma. And that's actually echoed locally. In most of our presentations, we try to do a before and after survey with the audience. Our epidemiologist put together a report in 2018 that found statistically significant positive shifts in attitude towards people with mental illness after the presentation. So there is an impact. I know when there's so much stigma in the world, it can feel overwhelming and like things aren't changing, but stigma is kind of one of those things that you change one conversation at a time or one training at a time. But as long as it's consistent, you work towards that change.
Yeah. What is it, I'm not asking for necessarily the scientific response, although I know you've read all of that research, but what is it that you share with people about the interaction with someone who has that lived experience that is so powerful, that has that power to open people to different understandings or possibilities?
I don't think I have anything scientific to say about it.
That's fine.
But, you know, just anecdotally, when you watch a Brave Faces presentation, you're seeing someone's vulnerability and there's a connection that maybe doesn't happen with all of the audience, but you can see people, so their empathy kicks in and they can relate to maybe not having a mental illness, but being in an uncomfortable situation or a situation where they have to be vulnerable. So it might not be the same experience, but, I think the powerful thing is being able to, tell your story full all the way through without being interrupted and just be able to lay it out and have all those pieces considered before, people start asking questions. I think that's part of the power of it.
Mm. It reminds me, not as in-depth or as intentional, of the Human Library Project that we did so many years ago. I think you were part of that. Were you?
I had a table. I had an outreach table.
Where people just meet, maybe not one-on-one or in a small setting, and hear someone's story, whether it's a veteran or someone who was formerly incarcerated or, and in that framework, it's like checking out a human book and learning. What kind of questions? So I know you have data about it, but what kind of reactions do you observe when you are there supporting the Brave Faces or being a Brave Face, and that you can tell through the kinds of questions that people ask or the insights that they share?
I think for some people, one of the things that when we ask, what stood out to you, people always note the bravery and the vulnerability. I think what happens kind of afterwards, after the presentation, you'll get people who haven't really connected with a community that supports mental health it's especially for like outpatient mental health treatment. Unless you're involved in something like one of our wellness centers, like Sunrise Mountain Wellness Center or Circle of Friends, it can be very isolating. It can be hard to find support groups. So it might be, someone who just got diagnosed and this is their first interaction with someone who has something similar to what they're going through. So I think those connections are something that's, sort of built out of these presentations. And it's, I think what's nice also about having a local speakers bureau is that, the phrase, like, you never know what someone's going through, so always be kind. Yes. Literally these people could be your coworker, your neighbor, someone that you regulars see at the grocery store, and you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. So, having that connection too, I think helps start to build some of the empathy in the community as well for people who might have a misunderstanding of what mental health challenge and substance use challenges are.
That's really helpful. And on the other side, I wonder about the experience of the people who are sharing, the ones who are being brave, both your perspective of someone who was a speaker and who now supports speakers. What is that experience like, and how do they process telling their stories? How do they care for themselves afterwards?
I guess to start on a positive note, a lot of people, myself included, just feel like it's a part of wellness. It can be hard. And even if you're not having the best day, for some reason, being able to tell your story and sort of, speak openly when you might have just internalized everything can have a healing part of it as well. So I think that's something that is experienced. On the other side, I can't speak for every brave face, or I can't speak for any brave face but myself, but there is a lot of nervousness involved. You know, most of the time we are very well received. Occasionally there's a person who, you know, has a set mindset and it, you know, this wasn't exactly what they wanted to hear today. So, but it is nerve-wracking. But what's also therapeutic and part of wellness is that, at least for me, was that I could tell my story and all of those, you know, core details are true and they're out there. But ever so often, depending on what audience you're speaking to, something else could come up that will help you understand your experience in the world a little bit, a little bit differently or a little bit better. I guess overall kind of like nervousness, mixed emotions, but overall kind of a therapeutic experience.
Well, you mentioned earlier just the power of being heard and not being interrupted or advised or the attempt to try to fix, which resonates so strongly with another both show that we do, but you are also a mind body medicine facilitator. You were trained as a mind body medicine facilitator, right? And in that model, which we haven't talked about really on this show, there's a learning skills for reducing stress and increasing well-being, but part of the longer groups is being able to share your story with no comforting or interruption or therapy, and owning that and how healing it could be. And I'm wondering for you, what other intersections do you see between that kind of work and what happens with brave faces?
You know, when you mentioned it, you know, knowing that model, like you said, like no advice giving, no judgments, just letting someone be in the moment, processing whatever they're processing in the moment. It's essentially the same thing as sharing your story, even though you're doing public speaking and you're not in a small group. It's that same space and almost that same courage to bring up what's coming up with you. You know, brave faces, a lot of the element, you know, are elements or things in the past. I see a lot of similarities between the way that group is structured and run and brave faces, and sort of, like I said, that therapeutic storytelling. Even if you're not, if you're telling your life story, you might be doing a brave faces talk. And if you're a CMB group, it might just be, you know, the day. But right. there is something to be said about just holding that space and not trying to fix things and not trying to edit or judge or anything about someone's experience. It's important to let people be experts in their own experience, because, you know, with all the advice in the world, you have to know in your personal experience what to do with it, I guess, if that makes sense.
So. It does. And in that model too, there's a strong belief that we know a lot of what we need. We have a lot of that inner wisdom, but there needs to be quiet and in order to access it. And that can also be quieting, you know, stress or anxiety or stigma or bias. And it sounds like in both arenas, having a safe / brave container or space for that is really important. How do you help the speakers create those spaces when you walk into new groups that you don't know? You don't know everyone there. What are some ways that you help to cultivate that safety?
So part of it is just the way the presentation is facilitated, you know, sort of setting things up with guidelines, making sure that people, you know, understand, the audience understands what's about to happen. And with Brave Faces, there's a lot of work that goes into sharing story for the first time. It's a process. We actually have people go through, we call it the Becoming Brave training. It's based on a national or international, I think now, curriculum called Honest, Open, and Proud. And it's a peer-led training that helps someone not only start crafting their story, but you're also going through the pros and cons of whether you want to be open about having a diagnosis. And developing strategies for you know, the people that you want to tell. You know, do you need to tell your employer about your mental health diagnosis, or that you need to you know, do some substance use recovery treatment? Do you have a family member that you're afraid to tell? You know, how do you test the waters to see who might be a good person to talk to and who might not? And also, empowering thing about that training is that it includes a section on addressing those internalized feelings of stigma, the self-stigma. And so all these little pieces help someone evaluate whether they really do want to broadcast their story, or if it's, you know, just something they want to, you know, share now and then with people who are close to them. Either is fine, and either is actually a way to fight stigma, whether you're broadcasting or you're having those individual conversations with people. So that's one of the ways, the tools that we give Brave Faces to share their story. And then we kind of go through a process of developing the gallery. And we have, for the first time, we usually have them present at one of our Stand Against Stigma committee meetings, because it's absolutely a safe environment to share in there. And we also try to, if possible, when we're working with someone who wants the presentation, to kind of tailor the presentation to the audience. So there is some, hopefully some already kind of connection or things that people can relate to.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of times the self-stigma that I think we have talked on the show about internalized racism, internalized idea, sort of acceptance, in quotes, of oppression that's going to be there. How do you help people recognize self-stigma, that internalized stigma that is operating, and how to loosen its hold, mm-hmm, on how you think about things?
I mean, that can be done with the training, or maybe just conversations in general. In the training, it's rated kind of on a scale to see, like, you know, wow, if my self-stigma is over here, then I really should probably work on it. And there's more tools within the training to do that. I think part of what helps people get rid of that self-stigma is also, you know, having those social connections with people, to where maybe you don't know exactly what someone's going through, but you've been through something kind of similar, and it's easier to identify and have support in overcoming that self-stigma.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. There are so many consequences that come to mind for me of the barriers that individuals face, and also that communities, limitations that communities experience when stigma is strong or unaddressed, unrecognized, unchecked. Mm-hmm. What are some of the consequences that you share with people of letting stigma be there? Things that in your discussion about why it's important to address stigma, that you bring up to make sure that people are aware how we're all losing out mm-hmm. from the stigmatization that we let flourish.
Mm-hmm. I think there's many myths and stereotypes surrounding mental health challenges and substance use challenges. But one of the ones that comes to mind as you're asking that question is the stigma that people who have mental illness or substance use, like they don't want to contribute to society. They'll never contribute to society, lazy. And what I've with Brave Faces is that and actually just anyone who's participated in the program is that it's almost the complete opposite. Having those social connections is important, and allowing people to like a lot of our Brave Faces either are volunteers, big on volunteerism, or are employed and working and helping to change the community. And when we perpetuate these stereotypes, like Patrick Corrigan said, we're interfering with people's full participation in society. So if we're going to solve, the issues that we're facing, like homelessness, and even substance use or adverse childhood experiences, we need people who have experienced these things to be part of the conversation. So I think that's one of the ways our community is missing out is by not uplifting and creating that space for people to be a part of their volunteer program or be able to share some of their experiences at work. It's going to take a whole community to solve these things, and you can't always do it from the top down. You need the bottom up as well. And you see a lot more peers get involved with things like advisory boards and things like that. So, and there's a big call for that. There's actually right now, I'm sorry if this dates the content, but the Mental Health Alcohol and Drug Advisory Board is actively looking for people with lived experience or have family members with lived experience. And, they get to provide feedback on current and new mental health programs and have a say in the yearly Mental Health Services Act plan. So all those voices are crucial, and people want to be a part of the community, and having all these different perspectives is really important to work towards a solution.
Mm-hmm. That's so important. I remember as a program evaluator, growing up or going to grad school during the day when collaborative forms of inquiry or participatory, that involvement of those voices was really beginning to be seen, that dates me, as so critical. And now more and more in evaluation work, that's an expectation, because really, how can you create sustainable programs that meet people's needs without asking them to participate in the design of mm-hmm. what those would be and what that might mean mm-hmm. for them. In addition to inclusion, I didn't count, but on several occasions you mentioned social connection. Mm-hmm. And certainly the Surgeon General, I forget if it's a couple of years ago, came out with that public health advisory, which is not very frequent, on the impact of loneliness mm-hmm. and social isolation. And that is not something that your average person would necessarily really think of in terms of being critical to our health and well-being. How do you help make those connections for people about social connection as critical to health?
I think, to stand against stigma, we actually, there are a lot of peer support specialists, whether they work at a wellness center or an HHSA, that are part of it. So I think there's more of a push to get more peer support out there, which is someone who can really walk alongside someone. And that social connection can be really difficult for some people. Like, some people may have anxiety that keeps them at home, and they, you know, and peer support is really able to go out and do that outreach and be like, you know, it might not be there, attend the whole support group for the day, but it's at least it's a push out there. So social connection is so important for people's wellness, because it not only helps combat loneliness, but it's also like you have an extra set of eyes of people who can say, hey, how are you doing today? You know, is there anything you need to be supported today? I think I've heard that as a mantra really in our peer community here, you know, how you support yourself today. And building those connections and keeping them helps keep people well. And I guess I will go back to my own personal experience. When I was diagnosed, I didn't meet anyone who had a diagnosis similar to mine, or anyone with mental illness, really, for 2 years after I was diagnosed. And that was in a time when we didn't really have peer support or anything like that. So it took a long time to kind of allow myself to come in to be socially connected to people. There was a lot of shame there, and it was difficult for me to have those social experiences. But I kept trying at it, and eventually you overcome it. But it was, but once I did have a group, and it wasn't necessarily like a support group for particular diagnosis or anything. Once I had a community I could be a part of, that's when I really started to grow and come out of my shell, per se. So, if you knew me 10, 15 years ago, it very different. Very different outlook. And that's actually another interesting thing about Brave Faces, is that the program has been around for over a decade, and we've actually been kind of celebrating and trying to raise awareness for that, that sort of long-term recovery that people go through, because we've had several speakers who have been a part of the program for more than 10 years. So it's an interesting sort of thing to consider in our community, is that look at long-term recovery, which often gets misunderstood. Like, relapse for mental health or substance use recovery is relapse happens. It's very common, but the more you have that sort of buffer, that community around you and supporting you, the more likely it is that you're going to succeed in your recovery.
Yeah. And long-term is such an important word there. I know in the communities, our member organizations that are working for criminal legal reform or just broader social justice issues, that is not a one event or one year or one piece of legislation thing. Or when I think about, you know, having lost my home in the car fire, we're still recovering. Landscape and neighbors and connections can have its place, but recognizing the ongoing nature, need for support is pretty grounding. Sets some more reasonable, realistic expectations. Mm-hmm. What has helped people pivot to that perspective, that acknowledgement that, you know, this is going to be, it's more of a navigation than a graduation, so to speak.
I feel like that's kind of been, I mean, at least through Stand Against Stigma, we've been trying to instill that in any of our presentations, you know, talking about that relapse recovery sort of cycle, and that, you know, people get beyond it. So, and I think sort of overall nationwide, we're seeing also just more people sharing their story about it. You know, we get to hear, we have a couple Brave Faces advocates who have had experiences with schizophrenia, and that's a very misunderstood diagnosis. It's interesting to see, hear the story and see how, figuring out, at what point did you get help? And I mean, that's actually a part of all of our Brave Faces stories, is there's the part that happened to you. And then there's the part where you finally, it clicked, and you said, I need recovery. And then you have those things that sustain your recovery, and talk about those and share those stories. So that's one of the ways that we're able to look at long-term recovery and help build that understanding that, it's not a broken arm. A broken arm, pretty much is going to heal in a matter of months. Whenever it's mental health medication, it could take months just to get the right combination. And then, some of our Brave Faces who have had very long-term recovery have even had points in their life where they had to have things adjusted because it's not a smooth line. And you still see the successes though. There's Brave Faces who have, shared their story and, had to be hospitalized at one point and then came back from it. They're getting their master's degree now. It's a process that just understanding it as a process is important. And I think we're slowly starting to chip away at that. So the more understanding, the better.
Great. And you mentioned schizophrenia is one area where you're perceiving there's a need for greater understanding that people, mm-hmm. Are there other arenas, other of your speakers or experiences that you're finding, because these things cycle, it seems like things that maybe that were stigmatized 30 years ago, we can make some movement, be more as a society, be more familiar with some things, and others kind of maintain their higher levels of stigma. Are there other arenas where you're seeing a deeper need for
education?
For education and understanding.
With some of the more diagnosis that would be considered serious mental illness, like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder. There's even, people who have intense anxiety. It kind of runs the gamut, but it's hard not to recognize the stigma with each and every one of them.
You have colleagues in other parts of the state who are operating in similar programs in more urban areas. I wonder what the differences are doing that in more rural serving areas.
Oh, okay. I actually don't have much contact with other programs. I know that there is a, in San Francisco, there's a mental health speakers bureau there that I think was kind of the inspiration for the one that we have here. And I've seen some counties do campaigns with people with lived experience. I don't have a lot of contact, I guess, with the rest of the state whenever it comes to stigma. There's, I see conferences and everything for like suicide prevention almost annually, but there's right. Not really one for stigma that I found. So.
Well, yeah, and I was wondering, because I haven't really heard about many programs quite like ours, and it would be interesting to see if what comes up or what are some of the differences in urban areas. I'm really personally very grateful that we have this, and all the people who have dedicated their time to speaking out and educating on a number of levels, right? Especially, and you mentioned people who are going to be in particular professions where it's critical for them to understand the experience. And, with the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, we've, and on this show, we've interviewed both first responders like Chief Schuler and others who are in the system, Chief Probation Officer Tracy Neal and others. And I wanted to ask you both about any of your observations or insights sort of on both ends, the beginning with the first responders, law enforcement, firefighters, EMTs, mm-hmm. what kinds of experiences do you hear them sharing with you around stigma that they've experienced or that they've recognized?
Mm-hmm. For all those occupations, law enforcement, first responders, military and veterans, it's and some of this is my experience as a veteran, it has been, I think it's changing now. We see peer support over at Reading Police Department, things like that. And even for our wildland firefighters, there's peer support programs there. But typically, in the past, at least, it's been sort of it could be a career ender, really. You might be skipped over for a promotion. And that's actually prevalent in law enforcement, but also it is prevalent for anyone who's in a mental illness with an occupation. That's always a fear. So having that fear, internalizing that stigma, then makes it harder for maybe someone who works as a first responder to learn about mental health. Although I see that too. I have a hard time not focusing on like the small little pieces. Like, I know that there's so much to be addressed, but you see some positive steps forward. Like I said, like peer support for first responders, like, having those crisis intervention team trainings, and having the crisis intervention response team and things like that. Like, it seems like as, at least in our county, we're starting to blend some of these and sort of develop that relationship with real contact. Like, the crisis intervention team does have a clinician that works right alongside them. And even peer supports are being embedded in the mobile crisis team to bring that lived experience in. So while there is a, overarching struggle with all of these things, there's those tiny steps that I've known as being a Stand Against Stigma coordinator and a community organizer, all those little pieces come together. And while there's still the struggle, there's change being made, even if it's in a small way.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. We spoke to members of Hill Country's mobile response team, and the crisis intervention team came out to speak to the SCJC. Chief Schuler just spoke about it and mentioned his working on a proposal to have, I think the words he used, to have law enforcement see a mental health professional at least once a year. I think he said, wow, whether they like it or not, which is great, setting leadership for, no, your mental health is really important to you. It affects your physical health. It was so good to hear him speak of that. It is those are all extremely stressful jobs. And I know at the SCJC, we've been very supportive of the investment in the crisis intervention response teams, and really hopeful that the sheriff implements one as well.
Yeah. And it's not, I don't want to ignore the stigma that happens, sort of in those interactions. Cause that is something, like, we have the Stand Against Stigma Committee as well, which is just people who come in and give feedback and share things in the community. And, we don't always hear the most positive things about interactions with law enforcement. And that's where the committee does try to work to produce messaging or tools or training that can help support building someone's understanding and trying to bridge those connections. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I know that you don't have like a speakers bureau completely focused on people who are formerly incarcerated, although there's lots of interactions with lots of systems for many of the people who have been in the program, or who have certainly people who have lived experience with mental health issues often have interactions with the criminal legal system. What are some of the things that you have heard about how stigma has impacted them in those interactions?
When I hear people talk, I know we have the barriers. We know there's barriers to housing, there's barriers to getting treatment. I think it's almost as if there could be a need for building understanding around what the whole process of, you know, leaving incarceration is, and how it can easily slip back into, you know, experiencing homelessness, or even, you know, experiencing reincarceration. I don't feel like I'm expert enough to speak on the process, but some of the little bits that I've heard about it, it makes it difficult for someone who's getting out to be able to reintegrate back into society in a way that supports them. So
So all those stressors just compound.
And then if you're, you know, with any stigma, if you're dealing with heavy stigma and internalized stigma, you're going to be afraid to go seek those resources, because even if it's a supportive resource, sometimes you're worried what the person you might be interacting with is going to feel about, whether you're incarcerated or maybe what your charge is and everything like that. You're going to be afraid to take that first step. Like we recently published a Brave Faces story of someone who was frequently incarcerated and then but wouldn't take those steps to get help because they didn't want to appear to be experiencing homelessness, because there was a fear of how they would be treated, because they've seen how other community members have treated others and spoken about others. So it's a difficult situation.
Yeah. In sociology, we talk about that as a stereotype threat. You have a you have a background in sociology.
I do.
a great degree in a totally unbiased way. the other thing I wanted to ask you, in case this is an arena where you work too, we often talk about policies and systems changes on this show and within the SCJC. And I'm wondering, for your program, are there particular policies or systems changes that you think would make an important difference? In the reduction of stigma.
Yeah. So one of the ones that I think would be helpful is just for every workplace to have some sort of policy on mental health, and having that seen as, you know, just as important as taking care of your physical health. Like a counseling appointment is just as valid as having to go get something physically checked out or having to get labs done or something like that. So, you know, and we spend so much time at work, you know, that's such a big part of our lives for decades of our lives, that I think it's important to have those policies in place. Maybe some, you know, training. Like one of the other things that Stand Against Stigma has done in the past few years is fund mental health first aid trainings. And they're good for anyone who wants to learn about mental health. It doesn't matter if you're a counselor or MFT. Mental health first aid is meant for everybody. And it's really good for people who might not have a background in mental health or sociology, but they, you know, work the front desk. It builds that understanding in a different way than storytelling does. And the trainings also help people gain skills to help someone in crisis. Like, they're not going to train you to diagnose anyone, but they can give you like symptoms and tools to really help someone who might have emerging mental illness happening, or that is in crisis, and, you know, have more understanding around it. I think one of my favorite parts of the training, they do a simulation where they simulate what it's like to hear voices. Mm-hmm. And how hard it is to think and to communicate through that situation. So the training has that empathy building aspect as well. Anything you can incorporate, especially into the workplace, and you know, acknowledging workplace wellness, like you know, maybe not a Center for Mind Body Medicine group, but you know, ensuring that wellness is a part of, you know, people you're supervising and everything like that. So, and there are, I haven't been able to take a really hard look at it, but I do know organizations like NAMI have stigma-free, like trainings and, suggestions for policy. Mental Health America has some of that too. That's another resource to look at for any kind of like systems change or policy that you might be able to implement. So
great. If people wanted to learn more about Stand Against Stigma or to support your work, what would you tell them?
Well, you can contact me for one, you can contact me directly, or, we did, because the pandemic, it was hard. We did only a handful of presentations, unfortunately, during the pandemic years. So, to kind of substitute for that, we really built up our website. And so everything that I've talked about in here and more is available on standagainststigma.com. You can view Brave Faces stories. You can find the under Get Involved, the mental health first aid trainings are in there, and you can download the flyer with all the training dates. We have information about our Hope is Alive open mics on there as well. And those are actually really, really like different experiences. They're also kind of an exercise in listening. It's one of those space building type things. So any type of performance, and we've had everything from poets to we had a sword dancer one time come to our open mic, and I know you host open mics as well. So
yeah, and I'll send you when ours are so that folks can come. But that, I agree with you, that I've come to a couple and they're just beautiful and very diverse. Is there anything else I should have asked you that I didn't?
We talked a lot about community support, right? Mm-hmm. So on standagainststigma.com also, there's a section under resources called community support. And there's information about peer support. There's a video you can watch about some testimonials from people who work in peer support. And then there's also, I try to keep the current wellness center calendars on there. And then there's also information about the local Shasta County NAMI chapter, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And they do a lot of support for families, especially families, parents, caregivers. And their information is on there as well as their monthly newsletter. If you're looking for ways to get socially connected, that's a great resource to start with for our county.
Great. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for spending time with us and explaining these things and sharing so many resources. And I'll definitely put a lot of that in the show notes and share it with in our SEJC newsletter as well. So thank you for the work that you do and all the support that you give to people.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc, and the views expressed here are of the host and interviewee and not that of KKRN, SEJC, or the ACORN board. Learn more and donate if you can on kkrn.org.
Oh, there'll be signs and wonders.